from what most Americans would consider morally acceptable, and I believe they will play a very important role in gradually reversing the policies and the actions that follow the policies that make so many people ashamed of our government and ashamed of the actions that have been taking place more recently at the U.S. southern border. But I emphasize, these actions take place in many cities throughout the country because of enforcement agencies like ICE implementing a horrible law like the one we passed in 1996.
And finally, we only have about 45 seconds, but if you could comment on how the change of government in Mexico may have an impact from your perspective on the continuing crisis at the border between the U.S. and Mexico?
Well, I mean, we are hopeful that the new administration will actually take a deep look at the policies that have been in effect over the past several years. I like to point out that following the so-called humanitarian crisis declared by President Obama in 2014, the Mexican government, for all practical purposes, became the extended border for the U.S. And we've seen a huge increase in the deportations from Mexico, essentially replicating the deportation practices that the U.S. had been engaged in. So we are hopeful that the new administration will again take a fresh look at this and reassess whether this is the right policy for Mexico, a nation that prides itself from saying that it is an international human rights leader. We just don't see that in practice, but we love to see that come to be the case with the new administration.
Oscar Chacon, we want to thank you for being with us. Executive Director of Alianza Americas, his recent essay, we'll link to it, Medium, Why Abolish ICE Doesn't Go Far Enough for Migrant Families. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening for a broadcast engineer here in New York City. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, or Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon.
We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and have an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO.
There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras.
So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate the 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station. KBOO Portland.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland. This is Roxanne.
To your home. When I get there, girl, you'll be gone. Tell all your friends about our love affairs and how I was just a fool. You tried to blow my mind, but the change was reversed this time. Now I can see the sun shining bright. Shining bright, look up into the sky, start looking.
strengths we have today that we need to
strive for. More liberty, lift yourself up on your feet. Let's get it on.
Pride and my joy because I
really
them black, black coffee. Burnt toast and drink them black, black coffee. Yeah, that's all she left for me. When I came home so late last night, looked up, found no one inside. Guess that I'll investigate. Yeah, who's been keeping my baby out late? Eating burnt toast and drinking black, black coffee. I'm eating burnt toast and drinking black, black coffee. Burnt toast and drinking black, black coffee. Yeah, that's all she left me. Black, black coffee eating. Burnt toast and drinking black, black coffee eating. Burnt toast and drinking black, black coffee. Yeah, that's all she left for me. Yeah, goodnight kisses were for me. Sweet as honey from a honeybee. Now you change your honeycomb when you get stung. Buzz, buzz back home. I'm eating burnt toast, drinking black, black coffee eating. Burnt toast and drinking black, black coffee. Burnt toast and drinking black, black coffee. Yeah, that's all she left for me.
Mike? Happy Wednesday morning. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am hosting the Wednesday morning talk radio show here at KBOO. And my regular host Paul is out of the country right now. He's in Europe, and so I am hosting alone. And so. This show, in particular, is about the recent sentencing of Redfawn Fallis. I don't know if many of you know her, but she actually is a Oglala Lakota woman who was arrested in October of 2016 at Standing Rock, and maybe you've seen the video of her, but it's pretty striking. She's surrounded by she was surrounded by five plus men in riot gear while on the front lines, and tackled and arrested. The video is online. You can just Google Redfawn arrest, and she was sentenced in late June, and I was there in North Dakota, and so I thought I would I'm going to read a bit from something I wrote after her sentencing, and I titled this "I Was Born Free: Redfawn and State-Sponsored Sexual Assault of Native Women at Standing Rock." On Wednesday, July 11th, Redfawn Fallis, 39, Lakota, and the most high-profile water protector charged with a felony at Standing Rock, was sentenced to 57 months in federal prison with 18 months for time served. Her legal team will have 14 days to appeal. Fallis was found guilty of one count of civil disorder and one count of possession of a firearm and ammunition by a felon. In the video of her arrest on October 27, 2016, Fallis, a medic at the camp, can be seen arriving on an ATV where a line of police in riot gear are faced off with water protectors. The wall of men parts and a deputy tackles her, saying he heard her shouting, "Water is life." Behind the line of armored law enforcement, five men pile on top of her. As they pin her arm behind her back and with their knees hold her legs down, the gun, which is not visible in the video because of all the men on top of her, can be heard discharging three times, apparently into the ground. It was revealed in leaked documents reported by The Intercept in December. Her boyfriend, Heath Harmon, 46, from the Fort Berthold Reservation, was an informant working for the FBI, and the gun Fallis had belonged to him. According to a motion to compel discovery filed by her defense attorneys, Harmon seduced Ms. Fallis and initiated an intimate, albeit duplicitous, relationship with her. He spent the majority of the 48-hour period prior to Ms. Fallis' arrest with her and had access to her and her belongings. He used their romantic relationship to rely upon her as an unwitting source of information for informant activities. Family members of Red Fawn told High Country News, that's who I write for, the FBI plant literally jacketed her by putting his jacket with the gun in it on her right before her arrest and planting items in her backpack. In leaked police drone footage shared by The Intercept, Harmon can be seen leaving on her ATV just 20 seconds after his reporter girlfriend's arrest. Seconds later, he spoke to a Dakota water protector who asked not to be identified and did not mention Red Fawn's violent arrest. In his leaked interview with Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, he claims he immediately returned to camp to collect all of her possessions and return them to her family on Standing Rock. This after his girlfriend was tackled by several large men for free speech in front of him. After giving false and contradictory testimony to law enforcement regarding the gun, he continued the pretense of being her boyfriend even after she was arrested. In leaked audio of their phone calls, Fallis can be heard tearfully confiding, unknowingly to him, a paid infiltrator, her fears and desire not to serve time for something she did not do. In 2012, it was revealed that in Britain, London's Metropolitan Police was running a top secret decades-long infiltration program, the Special Demonstration Squad, of progressive groups that led to long-term sexual relationships with women being spied upon. Some of these women gave birth to children by undercover police officers who never revealed their true identities. One of these women, identified as Jackie, later settled with the Metropolitan Police for £425,000, or about $560,000. She described the experience to The Guardian as being, quote, raped by the state, and was deeply traumatized after discovering the truth. I had a spy who was being paid by the government to spy on me, Jackie told the press. To the extent that he watched me give birth, he saw every intimate part of me. Native American women have long been the target of violence, both by the United States government through total wars waged against their nations to gain access to homelands and through a structural violence in the resulting colonial society that marginalizes them. A widely quoted 2010 Department of Justice report found Native women experienced rape and murder at rates nearly 2.5 times that of other American women. In some countries, the murder rate is 9 times. Criminal database statistics find that 70% of Native women's reported attackers are men, not of their own race, most being white men. Most American women are primarily attacked by men of their own race. More data is needed to address the vulnerable picture this paints of Native women in America. At the hearing, Red Fawn Foster, Lakota Dene candidate running for the South Dakota State Senate, and Ahunka, adopted sister of Red Fawn, recounted to the judge Fallis' history of abusive relationships that made her susceptible to manipulation by someone like Harmon. At the hearing, U.S. District of North Dakota Chief Judge Hovland granted Fallis permission to wear civilian clothing at the nearly six-hour hearing. She appeared shackled and wearing a traditional ribbon dress. It was, however, partly Hovland's refusal to allow for further discovery into Harmon's role in the defendant's arrest and of pipeline owner Energy Transfer Partners security contractors like Tiger Swan, who he determined were not part of the prosecution, that forced the defense to agree to a non-cooperating plea deal in late January. Under the deal, the most serious charge against her of firing a weapon at law enforcement was dropped. That charge could have put her in prison for 30 years. He also refused to allow any defense based on treaties that were violated by the building of the pipeline. At the prayer after her sentencing was postponed in June, friends, family, attorneys, and supporters of Red Fawn gathered for prayer in a Bismarck hotel room. Her Hunka uncle, adopted in the traditional Lakota way, and University of Colorado law professor Glenn Morris, spoke to those gathered, telling them that he had spoken to his niece that morning. She had already been in custody for more than 20 months. She told me, he said, I'm a wild Ogallala. I was born free, I will live free, and I will die free, and I know what day this is. That day was the 142nd anniversary of what the Lakota call Victory Day, the Battle of Greasy Grass, or as the Americans call it, the Battle of the Little Bighorn. In 1874, it was in search of gold that Custer led 1,000 men into the Black Hills, in violation of the Fort Laramie Treaty. Since then, mines on Lakota land have produced, according to some estimates, nearly 10% of the world's gold. In 2016, the battle was the transportation of heavy crude from the Bakken through unceded Lakota treaty lands, which potentially endangered Lakota communities and millions of Americans downriver, that precipitated the Dakota Access Pipeline protests at Standing Rock. It would seem with Fallis and several other Standing Rock water protectors, as protesters preferred to be called, still facing felony charges, the battle has never really ended between the Lakota, their allies, and the American government. So, once again, this is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am a Native American journalist living here in Portland, Oregon, and I am hosting the Wednesday Talk Radio show today, and I urge you all to call in and comment on this. The number here is 503-231-8187. The studio line is 503-231-8187 here at KBOO. And comment on this, the use of tax dollars to pay for FBI informants like Heath Harmon to infiltrate the Standing Rock camp and frame apparently a Native woman for having a gun, which was his gun, and criminalizing free speech of Native people. And these are your tax dollars at work, and I would love to hear what some of you think of that. So I have some interviews I did actually with Glenn Morris and her attorney, Bruce Ellison, and Phyllis Young, her aunt and elder there at Standing Rock. And so can we play the first part?
You know, as a number of people mentioned earlier today, I mean, water's life. It's the beginning of life. It's the sustaining of life. As we go back into the earth and become part of it, water is part of that.
The
KXL pipeline right now is slated to begin construction on in January of 2019. It is a hazardous transportation pipeline. It's going to bring tar sands and fracked oils from Canada and the western North Dakota. It's going to cut in a diagonal across most of South Dakota. It threatens and endangers about two-thirds of the water resources within South Dakota. It threatens Miniwichone because it threatens the Missouri. It threatens, actually, the pipeline, Miniwichone.
So we have a caller, I guess, go ahead, James. Hello,
good morning.
James. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. You know, I had not heard about Red Fawn sentencing and everything that went into that. I am so, I'm almost in tears. Like, we need... I'm Chicano, so I mean, obviously not a federally recognized tribe, but the one thing that we need to do as Native people to this continent is we really need to start reexamining our relationship with whiteness. You know, I have a hard time with a lot of my Native friends, whether they be in federally recognized tribes here in North America, or my Chicano brothers and sisters down south, or even some of my Native Hawaiian friends. You know, we have such a toxic relationship with whiteness, and it's just so unnerving that this something like this happened, where you can infiltrate somebody's life to the point of being able to take advantage of such private moments like that. And I wish I had more words, but it's like, what do we do? How do we explain to people that this, you know, how do we get through to our brothers and sisters about how to reexamine our relationship to whiteness?
Yeah. Well, I should note that Heath Harmon was also Native. He was working for the FBI. And but it does call into question, like, in what was so great about Standing Rock and the camp was just the feeling of how we all came together and as indigenous people and our allies, and we're living together and forming these relationships. And now that means that when we do this sort of thing, we can't even trust each other, you know?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I don't know. It's, I don't know. I wish, I'm so angry. I'm so angry. Like I couldn't imagine, you know, being a man, you know, being able to, you know, taking advantage of a woman like that, but let alone being somebody who's not only taking advantage of that relationship, but seeking to, you know, to overturn, and, you know, especially against our own. I wish I had more words, but we really need to examine those relationships. Like, when I say whiteness, you know, it's like, I mean, yes, Keith Harmon may have, I guess, even if he was a Native, I mean, obviously he's not working for us. You know, he's much more interested in preserving the status quo than actually, you know, working towards a world where we can be free to be ourselves in our own native land. So,
yeah, well, it's, I don't know. His tribe, the Fort Berthold Reservation, that's where one third of the Bakken is, and so his tribe is profiting a great deal from the fracked oil and the transportation of it. The idea that you could betray someone at that level, I mean, he continued to pretend to be her boyfriend even after she was in prison, in jail. And so she, they leaked some of the phone calls. Some of it's in The Intercept. And it's just, she's, you know, talking to him and confiding in him and thinking she loves him. And yet she would never have consented to that relationship if she had known he was an FBI informant. And this was a federally funded thing. Like, our tax dollars funded this.
If I give you my email off air, could you send me some links to read up on this?
Yeah, sure. And we'll also put some on the program page as well for Wednesday Talk Radio. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for bringing this to light. And I'm just sick to my stomach. I can't even begin. Thank you so much for bringing this to light. I really appreciate your work. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling in, James. So can we go to 1250 with the I have an interview with Glenn Morris, Red Fawn Fallis's uncle, and also he's a law professor in Colorado.
Did you say your name?
But I just want to caveat this.
Oh, sure.
There's some things that I'd like for you to hold until after she's sentenced.
Definitely.
And so I can identify those parts if you don't mind. But
no, I would. I don't want to do anything
because I don't want to name it. Right?
Oh yeah, just go ahead and identify yourself.
Okay. So I'm Glenn Morris, G-L-A-N-N, M-O-R-R-I-S. I'm Red Fawn Fallis's uncle. I'm on the Leadership Council of the American Indian Movement of Colorado. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Colorado at Denver. I don't know what else you want. I'm Shawnee by birth, Lakota by Honka ceremony, and let's see, I live in Denver.
And how did you, well, I actually wanted you to maybe, I really would, actually for the article that I'm writing now, I'm not going to write about too much about Greg Vaughn's case because I respect the parameters that she's operating under. But I do want to talk a bit about this being the anniversary of the Greasy Rats, and then some of the things that she told, that you mentioned at the beginning, that she told you about you know, being a wild Lakota. So maybe you could repeat that on.
Wild Lakota. Wild, yeah. When this sentencing date was set, all of us immediately recognized the day as the anniversary of the defeat of Custer at the Greasy Grass. And so some people viewed it as being a slight because it's a holiday for different reservations, including Pine Ridge. And so they thought, well, they're trying to do that to prevent people from being able to celebrate, and we have to go to Bismarck instead. But I never really took it that way. I wasn't exactly sure why it was set for this date, but whenever I would talk to her about the date, I would say, well, just talk to your ancestors, just ask them for strength and guidance and support, because that's a very auspicious day, and there has to be some reason why they set that day, compared to any other. And so today,
yeah, we have another caller. Oh, Elaine. Hi.
I just wanted to call in. This is the newest update I've heard on the Red Fawn case, and I think it's one of the most disgusting things I've ever heard of. And I'm not a brown person, and I'm not affiliated with any tribe, but I think that what I'm taking from this conversation is that it's not enough to go for the typical value system when we're approaching relationships anymore, because security is such an issue, especially in this day of tracing and wiretapping and spying and too many screens looking into our lives. I'm really outraged, and thank you for sharing this news.
Yeah, and how do you feel that your tax dollars paid for this, for the?
Well, it makes me want to stop paying taxes. You know, too many things are done wrong with my tax money, and you know, I think that's the definition of a slave nation. Not to be hyperbolic, but my effort and my labor is getting usurped for a really evil cause, and this is essentially rape in my mind. You know, this is an emotional rape, this is a social rape, and this is very much like a physical rape if they had a sexual relationship as well, because that's not something that I think you're right, she would have consented to. Like, that's not some kink or whatever, like having a government spy in your bedroom, in your bed.
Yeah. And yeah, would you support laws to prevent this sort of misuse of?
Not only that, I would support the prosecution of this FBI informant on rape, and I would support a war crimes trial of the government and the authority within the FBI who ordered this. This is very much like an orchestrated rape, any more so. And you know, it's another look at how rape has been used as a tool of weapon in war against women for centuries and generations and thousands of years. And so I think recognizing what is powerful about women, we can see how we're being attacked, right? So we can learn from this situation, and whatever tragedy is there, we can learn what is powerful about us ourselves, and what is powerful about what we bring to the world by what they're attacking and why. Mm-hmm. So I see men attacking women through relationships, through sex, and using that to disempower them, because that's where our greatest power lies. Like, men, this world needs us to be in partnership with them. This world needs women to be in partnership with the world. There's no replacing women. There's none whatsoever. Being subjugated like this is just another effort to take that power away and try and confuse us to what we can actually do and what value we have.
Yeah, it's I don't know if you caught the beginning of that latest clip of my interview with Glenn Morris, but I was asked not to report a lot of this until after her sentencing, because they were afraid the judge would actually increase her sentencing if we reported on this, anything positive about her case.
Oh.
And so, you know, I was faced with the option of reporting earlier to get the news out, or and possibly being responsible for her getting more years in prison.
Oh,
she ended up getting sentenced to just less than 5 years, with 18 months served, for time served. She was in jail for over 20 months.
You know, that's 5 years too long for a frame job. You know, that's not her gun. There's video proof that it was planted on her, and I've seen it. I think this whole world has seen it. But it's another fact that a patriarchal and misogynistic society chooses to ignore, because at the end of the day, this is obviously not about justice. It's about putting away powerful people that are a danger to the system. Thank you very much for sharing this news and making the hard decision as a journalist to stand in solidarity with your sister and say the truth when you could.
Thanks. Thanks for calling in. I like your ideas about prosecution for war crimes. It's a good idea.
Absolutely. I think that's what we should push for, especially as women. I want to talk to... All right, so I'm a white woman. And I want to say to anybody out there listening right now, if you're a Hollywood star or if you're one of those white ladies at the Me Too march or anything like that, if you said or tweeted or hashtagged Me Too at all in the last 2 years, you need to be hashtagging Me Too, hashtag Red Fawn, because this is rape. And you need to be pushing for prosecution. And you need to be beating your white men upside the head for living in a system where this goes unaccounted for. There's no frickin' way. There's no frickin' way that we can be silent about this. This is inexcusable.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. Right on.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah, I like the idea of hashtagging Me Too with Red Fawn. I think that's very. I think I'll skip ahead to my interview with Glenn Morris to the next one, 2138.
How do you see this case in the context of previous cases, for basically political prisoners?
I've always been of the opinion that Red Fawn was not arrested accidentally. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but Red Fawn was the very first person arrested at Standing Rock, and way back.
I saw the video, and it's really notable how they just closed around her.
Well, that was the most recent arrest.
Yeah.
But she was arrested on a misdemeanor charge, the very first person to cross the line, to go stop the bulldozers.
Huh. Would that be that Labor Day weekend, or...?
It was in August, I believe, in August of... I'll have to double-check.
Okay.
But this most recent, the serious charge... have you read those Intercept articles?
I have, yeah, and I...
So
we'll,
yeah, Will Parrish's pieces. So because Red Fawn, of course, comes from a very long line of resistors.
Yes.
And so her uncles, cousins, her mother, her grandparents were all AIM people, and Teresa was at Wounded Knee, Phyllis, of course, Russell Means. She was raised with all of those people, and so that's the ethic that she again carried with her. Well, that's not a mystery to the U.S. government, and so when this broke and thousands and thousands of Native people and non-Native allies began to show up, I think people really wanted, people in the intelligence agencies really were interested in knowing, identifying who the, what they would consider to be the ringleaders were, even though, as with our traditional indigenous societies, was very decentralized, was very almost anarchistic in the sense that, you know, the people from Yankton or the people from Pine Ridge or the people from, you know, Oklahoma and New Mexico, or people were in different camps and were making decisions on their own, but with a collective consciousness about supporting Standing Rock in their efforts to stop the pipeline. And so...
this is Wednesday Talk Radio, and my name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am a Native American journalist who lives here in the Portland area, and I am been reporting on the case of Red Fawn Fallis. And what you just heard was an interview I did with Glenn Morris, her uncle, and a longtime AIM lawyer and an activist himself, and she was recently sentenced to just under 5 years in prison. Basically for free speech. She was, I spoke to many members of her family and her legal counsel, and they feel that she was framed by Heath Harmon, another Native man who was paid by the FBI to infiltrate the camp and to start a relationship with her. He began a relationship with her, and it was his gun that was found on her, caused the more serious charges that could have given her up to life in prison. And so I'd like to urge you to call in if you have any opinions about the use of state-sponsored sexual assault on Native women standing up for their rights. The number here is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I've been working on a much longer piece right now about this, and also I'm going to include that in my book coming up, which is comparing the Bundy takeovers to Standing Rock. I covered both of these as a journalist in 2016. I presently have a book out now about Bears Ears called Edge of Morning, Native Voices Speak for the Bears Ears, and about the creation of the Bears Ears National Monument to protect over 100,000 archaeological sites for five different nations and in the Southwest. And so I thought I would share this. As a Native woman, the use of sexual assault, particularly that sponsored by the U.S. government against other Native women, is serious. This took place at Standing Rock at a camp with thousands of Native people and their supporters, and people came together in a really positive way to try to stop a pipeline that which the tribe did not give consent to, and which was on unceded treaty land, land that under treaty with the United States, the Great Sioux Nation still holds title to, still has a right to, particularly to the crossing on the Missouri River. And so when Red Fawn Fallis was standing up for her nation, for her Lakota nation, she was standing up for her rights. And she, when she was tackled by the deputy, he claimed that he heard her saying, "Water is life." And that was why she was tackled, was because she was saying, "Water is life." That is, simply put, free speech. She was tackled by over five men. You can watch the video on YouTube. Just Google or search for Red Fawn arrest. Big men, in full armor and riot gear. And then while she was being tackled to the ground, there were three shots heard. And you can see the kind of dust rising out of the ground beneath her. And it was because of this that she was charged with such serious felonies, which she had to do a plea bargain for to reduce the most serious one, which could have landed her in prison for life. And so now she's facing 5 years. And she was sentenced to 5 years in July, July 11th. So I have another bit I'm going to play. Can we go to, let's see, 2512?
Who she was, that the feds knew who she was, and that they were interested in monitoring the people who they considered to be either central or emerging leaders. In the not just in Ochente, but in the movement, because they were adept and perceptive enough to see that this was not simply about DAPL this was about.
Here you are.
Thank you. And even though it was the Obama administration, intelligence agencies,
sure,
we know.
Bring this over to you.
Thanks a lot.
Would you like another lemonade?
I'm good, thank you.
Intelligence agencies, their MOs, their strategic plans, their grand strategies, they transcend administrations. And so they might be working for Obama, but a couple of years earlier they were working for Bush. And so they know that the political winds change and things turn. So the rank and file people in these intelligence agencies, whether it's Homeland Security or the FBI or whomever, they have an interest in identifying for the long term who the potential leadership is, and I think that that's the way that they looked at her. Now, what made Pochetti very different, as indicated by Phyllis, LaDonna, Faith, the role of women was going to be critically important. That's something that the United States society generally is not ready for or accustomed to seeing. And it's something about Native history that they know nothing about, because they've adopted the stereotype of Indian women as drudges, as squaws, and not as political leaders, and not as critically important cultural, spiritual spokespeople for the nation.
So once again, I'd like to, this is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'm hosting today for Wednesday Talk Radio, and I am a journalist, a Native journalist, who covers a lot of stories in Indian country across the country, and I am, right now you're listening to audio from interviews I did while I was in North Dakota, and covering the sentencing of Red Fawn Fallis, a Oglala Lakota water protector who was arrested at Standing Rock in October 2016. The video of her arrest is on YouTube. It's quite shocking. She's tackled by five large men, and it turned out that she was actually set up by a FBI informant who was posing as her boyfriend in camp. She did not know he was an FBI informant, met him at camp, and would never have consented to this relationship if she had known he was an FBI informant. And so this is state-sponsored sexual assault of a Native woman. I'd like to encourage you to call in. 503-231-8187 is the number here in the studio. I have a book that I'm finishing right now, comparing the Bundy takeovers to Standing Rock. The book is called Standoff, and it really compares the two different poles that I see in society today, in American society. I actually considered calling the book American Standoff, sort of a play on Mexican Standoff, or sort of at odds with each other, to the point where, I worry sometimes this could create the end of the world. I know that sounds extreme, but when we look at Trump, and of course Trump is epitomizes the colonial impulse in this country, and I would say in Canada as well, and certainly the Bundys takeovers are enacting their colonial rights to land. And we just heard the news the other day that Trump is going to give a $12 billion bailout to farmers to help pay for his tax war with the world, and it kind of gives you a sense of whose country is this, and when you look at what happened at Standing Rock with the criminalization of Native people of Native descent in North Dakota, it really pulls the lens quite clearly. I think that one of the things I say about Standing Rock quite often to me as a Native person is that it made the military occupation of Native lands visible, right? This was a military response to a peaceful demonstration. And really, you know, the tribe was in the right. They have the legal right. Treaties are, which the Great Sioux Nation signed with the U.S. government and were ratified by the Senate. Right, are only signed between sovereign nations. The treaties are international law. They are according to the Constitution. You know, the highest law in the land, and so the Great Sioux Nation's right, or as we call ourselves, the Ocheti Shakoan, you know, the Seven Council Fires. My father is Yankton Yehonktowan Dakota, which is one of the Seven Council Fires. The area that the pipeline crossed that was being protested is within the unceded treaty land. We never ceded that land to the United States. North Dakota occupies that illegally. Morton County exists in defiance of international law. So all these legal structures that were thrown at to criminalize dissent are active ways in which the U.S. continues a military occupation of Indian land. This is why Indian people know if we stand up, we'll meet violent reprisal. While when you see what happens with the Bundys and they stand up, they're actually asserting colonial rights. And so, you know, the powers that be work with them. And now, of course, they are working with them to an even greater degree. You have Trump actively courting them. He recently pardoned the Hammonds, the ranching family here in Oregon, who Ammon Bundy took over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in protest of their the mandatory sentencing that they were subjected to for arson. And then of course one of the candidates to lead the BLM, the Bureau of Land and Management, that the Bundys were taking over areas in protest of BLM authority. One of the Trump is considering appointing a former Bundy attorney, an attorney that represented Cliven Bundy in the 1990s. Her name is Karen Bud Fallon, and she's the one that actually devised the county supremacy ideology, whereby the county is the ultimate authority in the land. And that the sheriff has more power locally than the president of the United States does, and it's a sort of ideology that that would give political power more to rural communities, to rural people, and take other Americans, sideline them, particularly when you're talking about issues of public lands and the rights of Native people, Indigenous nations, to those lands to protect sacred sites. And their own rights to the land, and so I think I have one more interview to play, and although I think it's almost, but this is a interview with Phyllis Young. She is an elder. She is Lakota, and so it starts at 33:17.
So you want me to?
Oh, just say your name, like I'm Phyllis Young.
That's my American name, you know.
Oh, yeah, what's your local
name? I'm Mini Yuha Najiwi Na Mini Tehiowi Machabi. I'm a woman who stands by the water and woman who loves the water. My colonizer's name, American name, is Phyllis Young.
Thank you. And so... how do you feel about the trials and water protectors are going through right now?
Today was a really emotional day because of who Red Fawn is. to me. One of our children. And having past experiences with trials, strange things happen. And bittersweet things happen. And there's strange bedfellows. So it's something that happened that no one knew was going to happen, and no one could predict what was going to happen with the judge.
So we have about a minute left, and I'd like to encourage everyone to call in if they can. The number here is 503-231-8187. And I will be continuing to host this show for the next month, and I will be bringing more information from different things I've been reporting on as a journalist nationally on Native issues. And you can see a lot of my reporting in High Country News, Yes Magazine. I've been in other places too, like The Nation and The New York Times. And I have a podcast called Not Your Disappearing Indian, and I will include a lot of links to articles about Red Fawn on the Wednesday Talk Radio website here at KBOO. And so I will have a lot more. I'll have three more shows coming up, and I will be featuring a lot more Native issues. One show featuring young Native young people who are working to become writers themselves. So I encourage you to call in and listen, and I really thank all the callers that called in today. I really appreciate their voices and their concern and their ideas. I thought they were really brilliant. So have a good week. I will be back next week, next Wednesday. Doksha, Hagoshi. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Don't say what you mean. That's Drinking for Puddles every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 8. Or at 9 next, it's Bookwaves with acclaimed author Richard Powers and his latest novel, Overstory, dealing with ecological warriors trying to save the planet. At 9:30, the Radio Zine hosts a conversation with Under the Tuscan Sun author Frances Mays about her latest book, Women in Sunlight. At 10, Air Cascadia, and at 10:15, Flashpoints. At 11, on the Recovery Zone, writer Rory Scranton talks